Hello and welcome everyone to this episode of Spotlight. On the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, the streets of the global capitals are filled, not just with solidarity, but with a fierce indictment. People worldwide are rising to condemn their own government's complicity in the brutal reality, while diplomats and the architects of Trump's so-called peace plan proclaim progress. The facts on the ground tell a different story. A story of a relentless genocide in Gaza, a story of illegal expansion and summary executions in the occupied West Bank, a story of a people being systematically erased, all under the watchful eyes of an international community that claims all is going well. Tonight, we cut through the false narrative. We stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people by speaking the truth to power and demanding to know how long will this atrocity be allowed to continue. To analyze and discuss this reality, we are joined by Mr. Mick Mapier, co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign from Glasgow. And Mr. Ali Hamiyeh, political analyst and military expert, joining us from South Lebanon. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you both for joining us in this episode of Spotlight. A very important day, and November the 29th has yet again come upon us. The solidarity of Palestine, however, the genocide continues. The occupation continues. Mr. Napier, I would like to go ahead and start off with you with these global protests. Let's go ahead and start off. What does the term solidarity actually truly mean when governments of the West continue to arm and fund this Israeli war machine?
Well, solidarity means what it meant for me as a young man with the Vietnam solidarity movement worldwide, which was successful in defeating American militarism. And solidarity meant that people in the imperial countries, many of them understood that the state that was carrying out a genocide in Vietnam or Palestine is also the enemy of many people in that country. That we don't stand on the sidelines and applaud. We see ourselves as an extension to the Palestinian struggle for freedom. And we see our fate and our future tied to that struggle. Because a state that can be actively involved in the prosecution of a genocide, that can commit which can actively support the crimes that we have seen over many decades, but very dramatically over the last 2 years, that state is the enemy of most of its citizens as well. Because this state has actively promoted the genocide. The British Air Force has flown over Gaza more than 500 times, supplying intelligence to the killers on the ground. And the minister responsible boasting about it. So the genocide is abundantly clear, and unlike genocides before, is really undeniable. But the complicity of our government, which in past genocides has been concealed, has been hidden, is very, very clear. So, for example, many of your readers might not even know that the British government and the Americans supported the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, that genocidal government. But virtually nobody knows about that today. But millions and millions, maybe billions of people know that Britain and America and the EU have been complicit in this particular genocide. So to answer your question very quickly, solidarity is understanding that the enemy of the people of Gaza is our enemy as well, and that we have no choice but to try to join in that fight in every way that we can, because if they succeed, it becomes a dark world for everybody.
Well, exactly. Mr. Napier, you mentioned something very important, and I'm going to bring that over to Mr. Ali Hamiyeh. Thank you very much for your patience, Doctor. When it comes to what Mr. Napier mentioned about there's even genocides that have been erased, no one even virtually knows about them because how good they've been covered by the U.S. and their allies. In this case, how effective can these international solidarity movements that we have specifically seen today, as they've been proclaimed as the biggest seen yet, be when these political establishments in the U.S., in Europe, and of course their own allies remain so deeply entrenched in, specifically now that we're speaking about Gaza, their support for the Zionist regime?
Well, let's say that the Western Hemisphere, and especially United States, and exactly the Israeli entity are very good in playing the role of the victim at all time while they are the executioner. And also they are very good playing at the media whenever they want to put something on the surface or underground. Let's see example, Sudan, it's still the same going on Sudan for years. And now they just take it out of the sleeve and they put it on the table and everybody is talking about Sudan. So they are very good at when they want to talk about a genocide or talking about nothing is happening or just bury it underground. Let's see what's going on now. We see the people are with the solidarity standing with the Palestinian people. The governments are acting complicity with the Israeli entity. The people are acting also to save the humanity. I'm talking in general. But the governments are killing the humanity. And especially when we are talking about Gaza. Gaza is the most certified genocide massacre committed by the Israeli entity for now. Since the Holocaust, what so-called, nothing is in our hand, but we believed it because we stand by a people that been killed and burned in Germany, and we have no evidence, solid evidence of the numbers that been killed. Now we are talking about Gaza in front of all global media and in front of all the people in the world being killed and being genocide and ethnic cleansing. And we can see that people are in one place, the governments are in other places. So who will be more effective at the end? I think the media will play the biggest role to just to put the spotlight on what's going on in Gaza, what's going on around the world, what's the government of United States and the Israelis. And also from time to time, we can see big role of United Kingdom and Germany around the world. But who can continue, who can consider and win the war of media? I think this is the best way now to put on the surface the war on media and the war for the humanity in Gaza. In this case, we have to be with the solidarity of the people standing with the Palestinian now.
Well, exactly, Mr. Hamia. And as we mentioned at the beginning in our intro, that we are laying out the complete truth, this false narrative. With that, you brought up something very important, that who's going to be stopping this as we see it's continuing. And let's go ahead and remind our viewers that with Mr. Napier, just over a month ago in Egypt, I mean, we saw these leaders, top leaders of these nations around the world gather with Trump, signed the so-called peace plan, and at that specific moment, many people had a sparkle of hope that, okay, maybe this can actually make a difference. Since then, these executors of Trump's so-called peace plan insist this is still working. I mean, do they not open their phones? Do they not see the media? Do they not see the images, as Mr. Hamia had mentioned? Do they not watch the same horrific scenes? Listen to these heartbreaking stories as we do. We have the acceleration of settlements in the occupied West Bank, where people are literally being kicked out of their homes, being beaten. And if they refuse, their homes that they've had for generations, they are killed. And of course, let's not forget about this continuation of genocide in Gaza. Sewage is flooding the tents. What exactly is this term working mean for these people?
I think it means that Israel is succeeding in killing a large number of Palestinians. Still, that's what it means. We're witnessing something akin to what we thought, or many people thought, was consigned to the history books with the great anti-colonial struggles of the 60s and 70s, where many countries in Africa and Asia and and Latin America became independent. And it was thought that that was the end of colonialism, because colonialism meant that Britain or France or Germany or America could go anywhere in the world where they had a monopoly, where they had superior means of violence, and take what they wanted. They could pillage, rob, exploit, kill, and even exterminate in many cases. Very few of your readers will know that Winston Churchill was responsible for killing 3 million people in Bengal in 1943-44, when there was plenty of food, but they arranged a famine. So that was the crimes of colonialism, and brown-skinned people were inferior and did not have the same rights as white people or their allies. In those days, Britain could invade countries because, quote unquote, we were Christians and they were not. That gave the European countries the right to exterminate and kill. That they don't talk like that anymore, except for Trump. But now it's we have democracy, whatever that is, and they don't, whatever that is, and therefore we have the right to bomb and kill and invade. I mean, it's not in the Middle East, but we're watching the news headlines today as Trump begins to invade Venezuela, just like a 19th and early 20th century colonial power. No excuse, no reason other than the thinnest one, and he's using aircraft carriers and will use bombers to defeat that government. It is open banditry. We are watching the wheel of progress run in reverse, and Gaza is simply the most extreme example of that. That ability, that readiness to exterminate people who sit on land that somebody wants. Somebody wants Venezuela's oil. Somebody wants the land surface of Palestine. Those who stand in their way have no rights. And the people who gathered in Cairo were simply Mr. Sykes and Monsieur Picot from the early 20th century, who divided up the Middle East, who drew the borders without any reference to the local people. Balfour said, "We don't take into account the opinions of the local people. They're not important." So this racism is so rampant and so extreme that the people of Gaza had no right to determine their own future. That was to be done by America and its allies and servants and clones. So it's a very grim situation, but we see rising anger. Thousands of people have been arrested and charged in Britain with terrorism. I myself have been charged with terrorism and face 14 years in prison for opposing the genocide. In Italy recently, we saw the dockers refuse to move Israeli materials and riots and street fighting in support of the Palestinian people against the Meloni pro-Israel regime. So we see a rising anger. It's certainly rising. And there's nothing strange about that. The barbarity of Israel, although it's far too slow, nonetheless, it's eating away at stability in the Western countries.
Well,
And
exactly, Mr.
millions
Napier,
of
if you don't
people.
mind me cutting you off, I do want to fit in some more questions as our time is running out. Mr. Hami and Mr. Napier spoke about what the Zionist regime has committed, what the U.S. has backed it with, its impunity, and of course, the continued silence of the international community. And he did speak about this agreement in Cairo. With the situation, we've seen, of course, that we're still in phase one, and we still see the Hamas fighters under fire, gunfire, still trying to search for the remains of the Zionist captives. And again, the phase one had, just to remind our audience and viewers, they were supposed to return the remains of the captives within 72 hours, which Hamas at the moment mentioned. This is definitely something nearly impossible because of the continued mass of rubble. And again, Hamas continues, wants to do this despite all of it, upholding their commitment to this so-called peace plan so they can try to get some kind of aid, the stop of attacks, anything to help the Palestinian people. However, on the other side, just one of the examples that we've seen recently on from Zionists on TV, we had a man on Zionist on live television on a Hebrew media channel actually making inhumane comments of a mother, Palestinian mother, who had lost her child, the death of her child, and he made a comment saying she's probably the one that ate up all his food as he died of starvation. I mean, this again, these ridiculous comments are what has let this regime gain the so-called selective application of international law. Mr. Hamia, with your experience with being there in another axis of resistance in Lebanon, axis of resistance in general, what is it that makes Hamas and the resistance uphold their side of these ceasefires, uphold their commitment, knowing what the other side is going to do?
Well, we know, we all know that Israel cannot be trusted. The United States is always creating some new annexes to delete all agreements agreed upon. And we, it's in front of us, 1701 UN resolution, 10,000 violation by Israel, none by Lebanon, and still the American putting pressure on Lebanon, not on Israel. And also the peace plan that we are talking about that been declared on Sharm el-Sheikh by Donald Trump, we all knew that only the first two or three items or articles out of the 20 points will be implemented. Because we know that the Israelis will directly will go up and say, we will not continue on such agreement. It's like a contradiction within Israel will be coming out, because we have to continue what we started. So even though there is agreements, they will not do it. They will not implement such agreements on Gaza, especially on Gaza and Lebanon. So what's like briefly complicity against the Palestinian, supporting the Israeli entity just to continue what started. They told Israel, just agree on the 20 points plan and then do whatever you want as soon as you receive all your hostages or your POWs from the Palestinian, then do whatever you want to do. And that's what they are doing. And exactly they are doing in Lebanon. We see that they call it the blue line in Lebanon, they call it yellow line in Gaza. They call it like exchange POWs in between Lebanon and Israel, and nothing is happening. And also with Gaza now, it's the Hamas is implementing all what been agreed upon, the Israeli not. I think that we are lost between the George W. Bush roadmap and the Trump peace plan. All what we hear is only saying and claiming of being with the peace plan, but no, I think now we are in a different stage. Israel at the beginning, they were calling with the Arabs land against peace, then peace against peace, now agreements against peace, and this agreement should be under and under the wing of the Abraham Accord.
Yes, well, Mr. Hamia, as you're mentioning, so basically what we're seeing, anything that comes from the U.S., the Zionist entity, it's the same agreement, just reworded. Technical terms have been perhaps changed, but it's the same thing that we've been seeing. And in response, the same reaction by the Zionist entity and its Western allies. Let's go ahead and get in a few more questions before we run out. Mr. Napier, let's go ahead and focus just a moment on the situation that occupied West Bank, because this is basically the world's attentions on Gaza, on Sudan, on other parts. The IDF, these settlers are carrying out what can only be described as summary executions there in the West Bank. Is this a deliberate strategy to shatter any remaining Palestinian social structure, in your opinion?
Yes, it is part of a long-term plan which accelerated over the last 2 years to drive all Palestinians out of Palestine and to replace them with Zionist Jews from around the world, to hold on to the land that was stolen from the Palestinians, which, by the way, this land in international law remains the property of the original Palestinian owners. But so to hold on to that, to hold on to that land, to drive out the owners, the native people, the Palestinians, it's very clear. Look, in science, if you have a simple theory which explains everything, this is like heaven. in this hellish situation in Palestine, a simple theory explains everything. Israel wants Palestine without Palestinians. In order to achieve that, they have to use massive violence, because you cannot charm the Palestinians into leaving. You cannot persuade them to leave. This is their land and they want to hold on to it. Therefore, great violence, ingenious violence, barbaric violence is absolutely a central part of the Zionist plan. And it has to be. It was against the black people in Australia. It was against the native people in North America. It was against the native people of Argentina. The colonists who moved in with their families began to exterminate them. That's what's happening. That everything else is just commentary. The only thing which can stop this is resistance across the entire region of West Asia and around the world by solidarity movements. We can contribute, to answer your first question, we can contribute through solidarity. That is by fighting on behalf of the Palestinian people against their common enemies by an amount that we can never know. We can reduce the enormous price of their freedom. Palestine will be free, but we can lower the cost of that.
Well, Mr. Napier, as you're saying, we can contribute to this. We do have around a little over a minute during this episode, and I would like if you could both kindly answer this question around 30 seconds. In a quick message to our audience, in the face of this ongoing genocide, what does a meaningful solidarity demand of us depend beyond protests? I mean, how can these people who are on the streets, as we saw today, in capitals around the world, force their governments to end their complicity and stop the slaughter now, not tomorrow, but today? Mr. Napier, I'm going to start off with you, please.
The same way that solidarity activity has managed to close down arms companies that were supplying Israel, has forced the Scottish government against its will to recognize the genocide and to support BDS. This is the way forward. And if we can learn from Italy in the last few weeks, that's the way forward to support the liberation of Palestine.
And Mr. Hamia, your answer to this question, please.
Yes, we should, as activists in the solidarity with the Palestinian people, to say that most of the governments around the world, and especially the United States and the Israeli government, to show that they are lying by declaring peace for the Palestinian cause and two states solution. And they are acting at the same time genocide against the Palestinians. So declaring peace and acting genocide against the Palestinian will not work. And we should work hard to continue in expose such lies to the media.
Well, with that, I'd like to thank both of you gentlemen for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. Mr. Mick Napier, co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, they're joining us from Glasgow. And of course, as always, Mr. Ali Hamidi, political analyst and military expert, joining us from southern Lebanon. Pleasure to have you both with us. Well, until next time, goodbye.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. Came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night. While the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right, but they're powerless voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله. لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions. And questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. That is question and answer on Islamic beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Karimi is over here from the Islamic House of Qom to answer today's question. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
So this is the term qulat, which is the plural form of ghali. We can say the singular form is ghali, which means exaggerator. Who were this group? And I mean, were there among the Shia ones? Or, Sunni Brethren has also got their own ghulat too or not? This is a major question for today's discussion. Okay, first of all, let's start about the history of exaggerators or ghulat. Who were they?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. So غلوف or exaggeration means to transgress the limits when it comes to define the status of the prophets and the imams. So it can be argued that it may happen within different religious traditions, and we see that this term, this root ghulov, appeared in the Noble Book of Quran in two cases, chapter An-Nisa, verse 171, and chapter Ma'idah, verse 77.
That's right.
In both cases, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala addresses Ahlul Kitab, the people of the book,
mm-hmm.
the Christians, the Jews, preventing them, asking them to turn away from ghulov or exaggeration.
Yes.
Chapter Nisa 171 reads, Ya Ahl al-Kitab, La taghlu fi dinikum.
Mm-hmm.
All the people of the book, do not practice, do not commit ghulub, exaggeration,
yes.
in your religion. Wa la taqulu ala Allah illa al-haq, innama al-Masih Isa ibn Maryam Rasulullah wa kalimatuhum.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus is only the messenger of Allah and his word, and he's not God.
Right.
So one case that happens uh-huh. in Christianity is the concept of Trinity,
yes.
and the claim that Jesus is God.
So the manifestation of ghulub for Christians is mentioned in the Holy Quran. That's right.
I mean, the
okay.
One of them at
one
least.
One of them, okay.
And also Ma'idah 77, Ya Ahl al-Kitab la taghlu fi dinikum. So this is the point that unfortunately some cases when, I will talk about the origins of ghulub, exaggeration, but one of them is too much love for a person, and which leads to people transgress the limits.
Yes.
And this discussion is the topic of ghulub, exaggeration, is explained in the various Islamic disciplines.
That's right.
So sometimes it's discussed in Kalam theology, because we need to know the true status of the prophets and our prophet and the imams, not to go to extremes. The other discipline is ilm al-rijal. Mm-hmm. We know that when it comes to each and every hadith narration, yes, we need to check the chain of the
narrations
one
right.
by one.
Okay.
So one of the issues that make a person, a narrator, not reliable, not thiqa, is exaggeration.
Exaggeration.
So if in ilm al-rijal there are discussions about some narrators who are among the ghulat. And of course, in fiqh, in jurisprudence, there is also a discussion about whether a ghali, an exaggerator, is a believer or not.
So when we are talking about a narrator being an exaggerator, what do we mean exactly? I mean, what specifications his narrations have to be considered among the ghulat, Sheikh?
So to answer your question, we may talk about different examples of ghulub, what makes a person a ghali, an exaggerator, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we have people exaggerating regarding divinity.
All right.
So to, for example, believe that a human being is God. As I mentioned, this is what we see in Christianity. And among the Muslims and among the Shia, we have had in the past some groups who believed in the divinity of, for example, Imam Ali alayhi salam, in a sect known as Sabaiya. And there is another sect called Khattabiya. They believed in the divinity of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So this is one example of ghuluv, to believe that one human being is God, which is absolutely rejected by the Imams of the Ahl Bayt alayhim salam. Or for example, we have a sect known as Ithnainiyya.
Mm-hmm.
They believed both in divinity of the Prophet and Imam Ali alayhi salam. So this is one case, one example, one application of the term ghulub. We have had some groups who believe that, some of the Imams of the Ahl Bayt, or all of them, and the Prophet, they share divinity with God. Now, our dear listeners, if they refer to books of hadith, sometimes they come to the term known as tafwil. So there are two cases that tafwil is used. One is when there is a discussion on free will and predestination. We have Asha'ira, who believed in predestination, and we have Mu'tazila, who believed in tafwil, and the Shia, who believe in al-amru bayn al-amrayn, neither absolute freedom nor absolute predestination. But the other case that tafwid is used is regarding a minority among the Shia. Of course, in the past, they do not exist anymore. They believe that God has created this world and then has given or has delegated the lordship to the Prophet and the Imams of the Ahl Bayt alayhi salam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, more especially. So, for example, creation, death, giving sustenance, all these were given by God to these people, was delegated. And delegated means to do tafwil, right? So this is another example of ghulub. The third is to believe in a kind of incarnation or indwelling of God in a human being. Or, for example, there is a union between a human being and God. We have had, for example, in a group among Kaysaniya, who believe that the Spirit of God has incarnated in Prophet or Imam Ali alayhi salam or Muhammad bin Hanafiya. Also, to believe that someone is the Son of God. This is another type of exaggeration, yes, as some Christians believe that Jesus is Son of God. And according to the Quran, some Jewish people believe that Uzair is Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when it comes to Mahdism, to believe that some people who were ordinary people, yes, are the promised Mahdi. This is another type of exaggeration. In the past, in the history of Islam, we had, as I mentioned, Kaysaniya, who believed in Muhammad bin Hanafiya to be the promised Mahdi. Or Nafs-e Zakiya, they did not, these people may have not claimed Mahdism, but other people claim that these are the promised Mahdi. So some people believe in Muhammad bin Abdullah bin Hassan, known as Nafs-e Zakiya, to be the promised Mahdi.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
So in Sufism, or in some part of the Tasawwuf, also, we can say the exaggeration in the character of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Some of them
is over there, that Ali is God or something like that. And the non-Shias accuse Shias of shirk or something like that. Or, for example, Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam. So exaggerations exist everywhere. In all sects, in all denominations of all religions, we have exaggerations. But is it clear why? I mean, why such people might exaggerate about their figures, the holy figures?
At least when it comes to our case, I mean, exaggeration within the religion of Islam, mm-hmm. and some of these factors can be extended to other religions, we can think of different factors. Sometimes the historical sources give us this impression that sometimes there were political motives behind this phenomenon of exaggeration.
All right.
Meaning that, I mean, some exaggerators were not, for example, true Shia, true Muslims. They just became within the community of the Shia, and then to exaggerate about the imams so that, politically speaking, they could turn away other people from the imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. And that is one of the reasons that we see a very, very serious reaction of the imams from Imam Ali alayhi salam onward against the exaggerators.
That's right.
They were very serious against them. Sometimes the imams cursed the exaggerators and asked the Shia to, I mean, be away from such people.
All right.
I mean, pay attention to their children, not to associate with the exaggerators. So political motivation is one of them. We may call backwardness, intellectual backwardness, as another reason. As I mentioned, sometimes people, I mean, love someone, but they go to extreme out of their ignorance.
That's right.
And the other point is, worldly motivations.
Mm-hmm.
We have had in the history of Islam that some people, of course, very few in number, they try to exaggerate about some of the imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam so that they could continue to work as their deputies and representative and collect some money from the people.
Okay.
So these are some of the factors mentioned as the sources, as the factors, reasons for exaggeration. But as I mentioned, we should not forget about the fact that in some cases we should take into consideration the role of the enemies of Islam and the enemies of the Shias.
Mm-hmm.
They try to educate some people and then send them as, let's call it, spies among the Shias, among the Muslims, so that they go to extreme, they have some exaggerative claims, and they mislead the people.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last maybe 2 centuries, we need also to take into consideration the role of the superpowers, the colonialists, okay? They also had some role in it to mislead some individuals and send them as, their deputies, their spies among the religious communities, and they mislead the people. So these
That's
are
right.
some of the various factors,
mm-hmm.
and I believe, all of us should take care of that. We need to take our religion from the true Shia scholars.
Yes, authentic
we need
resources,
to refer to
right.
the Quran, the narrations, to know the true status of the Prophet and the Imams, and not to go to extreme regarding that.
That's right. Okay. So
and sometimes going to extremism will lead to superstition, Sheikh.
Sure.
Something which is believed by the masses and public people, you know, something, some powers which are attributed, for example, to prophets or the imams, which imam themselves, as you said, criticized truly at their time when they were living. About Mahdism, this is so. I mean, sure. Because imam is a major occultician, so many false claimants will attribute something which is unauthentic to the holy imam. That's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of ghulat or exaggerators. Ghulat is the plural form of ghali, means exaggerator. It was very kind of you, Sheikh. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. Please, for more information, visit our website, iranradio.ir. To another episode, we leave you in Allah's care. Goodbye.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to all listeners of Iran Radio. Greetings to you wherever you are in the world. I'm Asma, your host for the next hour here in Tehran. We'll start this hour's lineup with a radio productions feature that will be followed by Leader's Speech. The program presents a selection of statements and speeches of the honorable leader of the Islamic Revolution. That will be followed by Radio Productions feature. After that, we have For Humanity, a variety of subjects from the Holy Quran, which predominantly tend to be social issues, are addressed in this program. Stay with us for the next hour.
Nearly 300 journalists and media workers have been killed since Israel's genocidal campaign on Gaza began 2 years ago. According to the Shireen Abu Akleh Observatory, the overwhelming majority were Palestinians. The International Federation of Journalists confirms at least 246 journalists have died across the region, 223 of them in Gaza alone. No war in modern history has claimed so many members of the press. Not World War II, not Vietnam, not Iraq or Afghanistan. Gaza has become the deadliest place on earth to practice journalism. These are not accidental deaths or unfortunate coincidences. They are the result, many human rights observers say, of a deliberate campaign to silence witnesses. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression, Irene Khan, has called it an effort to kill the story. Israel, she says, first delegitimizes journalists, labeling them as sympathizers of terrorism, and then eliminates them. It's not only about killing journalists, she said, it's about killing the truth. On August 10, 2025, an Israeli airstrike hit a tent sheltering journalists outside Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Five Al Jazeera employees were killed, among them the network's well-known correspondent Anas Al-Sharif. Only weeks earlier, an Israeli army spokesperson had accused Al-Sharif of being a member of Hamas's military wing. His death, like so many others, fits a now familiar pattern: a public accusation, then a strike. Israel denies deliberately targeting reporters, but human rights groups, the UN, and press freedom organizations have compiled evidence suggesting otherwise. Reporters Without Borders has filed five separate complaints to the International Criminal Court, alleging war crimes and deliberate targeting of journalists in Gaza. Their most recent filing, in August 2025, documents the cases of 30 journalists attacked by Israeli forces, 25 of them killed. Foreign journalists have been barred from entering Gaza for much of the war. The only exceptions are a small number allowed to accompany Israeli troops under strict military censorship. That means the world's understanding of this conflict, the images, the eyewitness accounts, the record of destruction, depends almost entirely on Palestinian reporters working inside the enclave. These are journalists who have endured displacement, hunger, exhaustion, and constant fear, yet continue to record the devastation. With international correspondents kept out, they have become the world's last remaining witnesses. For Israel, this control of the narrative is no accident. Critics say the regime's campaign to manage what the world sees is as strategic as its military operations. Controlling information, they argue, is part of controlling the territory. Since October 2023, Israel has shut down foreign media access, censored domestic coverage, and outlawed outlets deemed hostile to its war aims. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's promise to recolonize Gaza is not just about reclaiming land. It is also, as one analyst put it, about recolonizing the story, erasing the ruins, the dead, and those who tell the stories. The scale of the loss among journalists is staggering. According to the Brown University CASA War Project, more reporters have died in Gaza than in all major wars involving American journalists combined, from the U.S. Civil War to the post-9/11 conflict in Afghanistan. The International Federation of Journalists, which marks its centenary next year, says it has never recorded such a massacre in its ranks. Gaza, they warn, has become the graveyard of journalism. But behind every statistic is a human being, a young camera operator running toward the smoke instead of away from it, a radio correspondent filing one last report before the power cuts out, a mother who texts her children before heading out to film another bombing. Families wait in vain for loved ones to return from the field. Often what comes back instead is a camera bag or a press vest covered in dust or blood. For many, survival has become secondary to bearing witness. The war has also exposed the fault lines of Western media itself. Even as Palestinian journalists risk everything to document atrocities, their work often struggles to break through global information filters. In many mainstream outlets, coverage has relied heavily on Israeli official statements and framing. Language itself has become a battleground. Despite a UN commission's finding that Israel's actions amount to genocide, most major Western media have refused to use the word. Words are softened, atrocities sanitized. In the process, the truth that Palestinian journalists die to reveal is often diluted beyond recognition. As one media scholar observed, when the images reach Western newsrooms, they are filtered through the need to appear balanced, and that balance often comes at the cost of accuracy. What makes Gaza so devastating for journalism is not only the number of lives lost, but what those deaths signify. When governments learn that killing reporters carries no real consequence, it sets a precedent. It tells the world that silencing the press can be a legitimate instrument of war, and the world so far has allowed it. Neither the United Nations nor the major powers have intervened to protect journalists on the ground. The United States, Israel's largest military backer, continues to supply weapons even as evidence mounts of systematic targeting. The silence is deafening. The maxim taught in every journalism school, no story is worth a human life, was meant as a safety rule, not a surrender. In Gaza, that principle has been tested to the limit. The journalists who remain know the risks. They film from rooftops, knowing that Israeli drones can recognize press vests. They edit stories by flashlight, knowing a strike could end their lives at any moment. And yet they persist, because stopping would mean silence, and silence would mean erasure. Anas El-Sharif, the Al Jazeera correspondent killed in August, once said in an interview, "We don't want to be heroes, we just want to be heard." His words now echo as a collective epitaph for the 223 Palestinian journalists who have died since the war began. Their deaths are not just a tragedy for their families or their profession. They are a tragedy for truth itself. If journalism is the first draft of history, then history is being written in Gaza in blood and dust. Every fallen reporter is a page torn from that record. The question for the world is whether we will allow those pages to vanish, or whether we will finally confront what it means to live in a time when killing journalists has become routine. Because when the witnesses are gone, the lies remain. And without witnesses, there is no history, only propaganda.
Tonight, a tiny angel sleeps on my knees. She's only 5 years old, but her heart's bigger than the seas. Tonight, our house is filled with the sound of the angel's wings. She has so many more friends in the skies than on the earth. Oh, my daughter, you're my sword, you're my calm in the storm. All my dreams will come. dream of a holy sun rising and this dead world starting to blue. Oh, my daughter, you're my soul, you're my calm in the storm. All my dreams have come true 'cause of you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
This is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a televised address to the Iranian people on September 23rd, 2025. Now, the U.S., came and bombed Iranian enrichment facilities in this and that place. The point is that this is a science, and science cannot be destroyed. Science cannot be eliminated by bombs, threats, and such things. It exists. As I said, and I'll repeat it, we have tens of distinguished, skilled scientists and professors, hundreds of students, and thousands of trained people working on various nuclear applications. For example, I didn't mention medical treatments when listing nuclear applications, but it is one of the most important areas where nuclear enrichment is used. A large number of people are working in various fields of medical treatment. The same is true for the agricultural and industrial sectors, as well as many other areas where people are working and putting in effort. Of course, during these past few decades, when we have been carrying out this work in our country, the pressure is on us, on Iran, on our country's officials, and on our administrations have been immense.
Subhanallah.